Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu.
With a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening.
Our scripture comes to us this morning. I'm reading from the prophet Micah. I'm going to read from the fourth chapter, the first four verses, and you can follow along on the screen. In the days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be raised up above the hills. People shall stream to it, and many nations shall come and say, "Let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, that he may walk in his paths." For out of Zion shall go forth instruction and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And God shall judge between many peoples and shall arbitrate between strong nations far away. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. But they shall sit under their own vines, under their own fig trees, and no one shall make them afraid. For the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken.
Run, Mary, run. That king wants to kill your baby son. Run, alien, run. Run, alien, run. The days of our open arms are done. Peace on earth, goodwill to all.
More so than usual, I've struggled this week. It's always daunting to imagine standing before you all and trying to share a message that is significant and woven in God's threads of grace. But it have felt even more challenging this week as I was trying to reflect on how I might come before you and talk about guns and gun violence and what our Christian, both scripture and tradition, might have to say as we try to move in this way. So I started this message actually a number of weeks ago. I started reading and then meeting, sitting down to listen to a lot of your stories. One of the people that I sat down to listen with is Jacob, who's a young police officer in our community. He recently was shifted from his work in a jail to patrolling the streets, keeping the peace in South Sacramento. I sat down for coffee with Jacob, and one of the first things that he said and that I heard as I listened to him was just about the gulf between my own, the experience I take for granted so often, the tree-lined streets of East Sacramento that I walk past to come to this sanctuary, and the often harsh reality of the streets that he is assigned to keep safe just south of here. Those can sometimes become chaotic. And it is a challenge for him as a police officer, as a young police officer, to move in those. I asked him questions and then listened to him share a little bit about what it was like to be trained to use a firearm as a police officer. I listened to him share about what it's like to pursue a person that you know is armed in the middle of the night and what comes up for him. And now as he and his partner start to think about having children of their own, how different that feels now than when he started out in the police force not very, very long ago at all. I anticipated that we would talk about things like gun violence and gangs and the pervasiveness of illegal guns in South Sacramento. And we did. We certainly moved in that direction. But what I did not anticipate was the amount of time that he shared about how most of his work is actually about calls to apartments and homes around domestic violence and around homelessness. That's how he spends most all of his day. And so one of the things that arose for me most vividly in talking with Jacob was this reminder of just how incapable we are as a society of watching over each other in love. We have really failed each other in this way. People in homes and apartments calling over and over the same police number because they can't figure out, we can't figure out how to live peacefully with our family, the ones that we're supposed to love the most, or our neighbors. Businesses, even churches in our own neighborhood, calling the police over and over because we simply don't know what to do with the unhoused folks who've taken up residence in front of our doors. And so because we don't know how to watch over each other in love, or we've forgotten how, or we're not willing to do the hard work of doing it, we create a police force and a military to do that on our behalf. And so the state sanctions violence. And oftentimes, maybe most of the time for a lot of us, that feels essential, and it provides a sense of peace. But too often, obviously, that fails. And those failures take so many different forms. They take the forms that we heard about in the Brilliance's song, Run. Mass shootings, schoolyards. Suicide. Toddlers triggering off weapons in homes and accidentally killing folks. Their own family members. An armed woman trying to stop a shoplifter who has lifted something from a store and shooting the person in the back while they run away. A police officer shooting an unarmed black child who's just trying to play, like my daughter was yesterday at the playground. And we don't let ourselves stay in that grief. We jump. We jump to gun control. And we jump and say that all of this has to stop and we should legislate it. And then gun owners defensively respond. This isn't about lawful gun owners at all. It's not about us. It's about the bad gun owners. And a friend of mine who's a pastor who I went to seminary with, his name is David Lewicki, and David and his family live in Georgia. And he wrote an article in the Christian Century last month that helped me to stand here this morning in more than just silence. And so I want to lean into some of his words and invite you to do the same. He shares that the truth, the reality, that as this happens, we heap outrage and moral indignation upon each other. And we talk right past each other. And one side imagines that laws can rid us of mayhem and disorder. Laws can do that. And then the other side says, or pretends, that mayhem and disorder aren't really that bad, or they're not our problem at all. And both sides, maybe both sides are right in part, and probably both sides understand that gun control and gun rights don't really address these deeper problems that we as a society and culture actually find ourselves in. So this morning, I want to try to spend a little time inviting you to journey with me where I've been these last few days and weeks and thinking about this, to try to reflect together on some of what might be underneath all of this and to wonder about how our actual choices, our actions, our words, our silence might be rooted in the biblical witness and in our Christian tradition and help us to have honest and vulnerable and I hope constructive conversations about these things. And David did this in a way that really helped me this week, and so I want to invite you into it with me. It's an exercise that he shared, and I'm going to use a lot of his words. It helped me kind of move past a lot of the places of stuckness that I found myself as I've journeyed this week, and helplessness in responding to this reality. So he says, every time that there is a mass shooting, he imagines himself as a victim. And perhaps a lot of us do that. What would it feel like to be in the classroom or in the clinic, going about your daily life, only to see someone suddenly coming toward you with weapons. What would you do? What would you say if that was pointed at you? What does it feel like to have a bullet actually enter your body and see the blood pour out? And to think or to even know that you're going to die? David's invitation to imagine that brings up all kinds of feelings for me, or it has this week of terror. It engenders a deeper sense of empathy for me and like the unimaginable of what's going on. When I think about it, Lynn and I were doing worship planning just, I don't know, a month ago or so, and the lockdown that got called in Los Angeles and then made fun of in New York City, it created panic for me because my kindergartner was an hour and a half away and I couldn't get there, right? And so it does that. And for me, I don't know what it does for you, but it creates a sense of rage about guns. I have to acknowledge that. It reminds me how much I despise them. And if it were up to me, I think we should melt all of them down and make them into farm tools, kind of in the vein of Prophet Micah and Isaiah. I want to be honest. That's how I feel about it. And that's how they say it. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. And David's exercise helps me into that, but then it takes me to a much deeper, deeper place. He then invites us into an act of sympathetic imagination. And this one I had not pondered before I read what he shared. He wants to invite us to imagine ourselves as the shooters, not just as the victim, but as the shooter as well. What does it feel like to hold a gun and to point it at someone with an intent to kill that person? What goes through your mind as you carefully pull into a parking space and then enter into a school or a clinic? Your trunk full of weapons, your plan is to end innocent life. What does it feel like the moment you decide that you intend to take the life of someone else? What happens when you see that person's actual eyes right before you? What could it possibly feel like to eat breakfast the day that you plan to murder innocence? And that was much harder for me, obviously. Like, I don't want to go into that place. It brings up a different kind of terror inside of me, like a nauseousness in my stomach. Like, it's too much to stay in it. And my sense is, my guess is, that some of us aren't ready or able to even come close to imagining ourselves in that exercise. But as I've sat with this over these last days and weeks, I've come to believe that we need to start to see ourselves in the mirror of both the victim and the shooter and the perpetrator. See, mass shootings, as David has reminded me this week, they're about us as a people, as a culture. They are a mirror that shows us who we are, who we really are. They show us back the parts of our society which fail, just utterly fail. And they show us a society that pushes loneliness into hopelessness, and then into desperate corners, and then into isolated pockets, as David writes, of the internet. And they show a society that glorifies and then reifies the use of violence to solve problems. And this isn't just out there for me. I was talking about with Brendan about this. I came in this morning. It's as real as watching the Cincinnati Bengals Steelers game yesterday. And we as a culture want to like watch number 55 literally knock out the wide receiver from the Steelers. And we want to say, oh, he's being reckless. He is out of control. He is a bad football player. That's what football is, people. Like, he's doing what we pay him millions of dollars to go and do, and he only gets to do that because people like me watch it and get excited about it. And so I have to confess that, like, when I look at these problems, we create all these things in how we live and move and have our being. We are, in that sense, we are the mass shooters. They're created from within us, and they bring into full view all these aspects of ourselves that we wish didn't exist and would rather turn away from. We don't want to hold that mirror, but can we afford any longer to not look at who we are and how we are? David writes, and I resonate, we are a society that creates mass murderers. We are also the victims of the violence. We bear the wounds. We grieve. We live with the burden of these horrible memories. We are at war with ourselves, and we're murdering ourselves. And so I turned from David's writing to a Croatian theologian who knew civil war himself, Miroslav Volf. We've used his work here quite a bit. And he writes in an article called Christianity and Violence, "Religion is more associated with violence than with peace in the public imagination, partly because the public is fascinated with violence. We, the peace-loving citizens of nations whose tranquility is secured by effective policing, are insatiable observers of violence." We all are. "And as voyeurs, we show ourselves to be vicarious participants," he writes, "in the very violence we outwardly abhor." We're caught up in it. So I wish, with all of who I am, I wish that stricter enforcement of gun laws and enhanced gun safety technology and increased spending on mental health infrastructures could resolve the epidemic of gun violence that we have in our nation. As important as those all clearly are to me, I fear that these ways forward only work in part. They only work in part. And I'm part of a United Methodist Church that has a position on this and so many different other things. And one of our position statements says, "The United Methodist Church is among those religious communions calling for social policies and personal lifestyles that bring an end to senseless gun violence." And so that's a start. It kind of puts us in a direction. And then it's our task to figure out, what does that actually mean and look like in our everyday lives, in a nation where 300,000 guns will be stolen this year, 300,000. Like, think how many you have for 300,000 to be stolen. Over 32,000 people will die of firearms here in our country this year. And all the while, Smith and Wesson, their value as a company has gone up 80% in 2015. 80%. And to put that into context for people like me that don't really understand the stock market or the value of a company, if they were on the S&P 500, they would have been second in growth last year. Like, think of Apple. How many of us have iPhones, right? They dominate Apple. That's phenomenal to me. So I want us to just hold that reality for a moment. 32,000 people, more than that, will die this year. It means that statistically, since worship started, someone in our country has lost their life to a firearm. All the while, the value of the company that makes those has likely gone up. That is hard to get our heads around. So this morning, I want to invite us to hold that reality in tension with the prophetic witness of Scripture and our Christian tradition to try to discern some ways that we might respond. And over the next 5 weeks, we're going to try to put topics that divide on the table in this way. And I know that some of you are anxious. Several of you emailed me saying you were anxious. Some folks aren't going to even be able to stay here at the table. They're going to ask to be excused or not ask. Just like push the chair in and run away. And I get that feeling. I get why we want to do that. It's why I think in part it was so hard for me to get ready for this morning. Thankfully, this isn't the first time we've tried to do this at the table. In 2014, we did a series that was called Don't Talk About That at the Table. And we talked about immigration and prisons and race and gender and sexuality. And you can find that on our podcast. Inevitably, when we do this, we try to talk about controversial things. Inevitably, someone steps forward to express a concern that sounds something like this. This is a political issue. We're a church. We should not talk about politics in church. These two things should be separate. And there are certainly political dimensions to all of these things that we're going to talk about. But what happens in our communities because of guns and gun violence is so profound that I believe we as a community of faith have not only a task but a responsibility to try to work on this together. A profound responsibility. Jesus did not shy away from the challenging issues of his day. He actually begins in the Gospel of Luke in chapter 4. He's beginning his ministry in Nazareth. So this young Jesus stands up and the people, his home, right? The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because God has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. God has sent me to proclaim release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord. That's like all bound up in economics and politics and all of it. Like, that's just who Jesus was. And if we don't like that, I don't honestly know what to say other than that's who Jesus was, and we got to deal with that on some level. The way the people around Jesus dealt with it was they tried to hurl him off a cliff. That's what they did next. They drove him out of town and tried to hurl him off a cliff. And I think that's what happens when we try to actually face in the mirror the reality of the intersections of politics and economic injustice and violence. When we do that, we want to hurl things off cliffs. Sometimes people want to hurl me off of a cliff. Some of you might want to. That's okay. We actually hope, and we even feel a responsibility as your pastors to ensure that that we try to talk each other down from hurling each other off of cliffs. That would kind of be against the vein that we're trying to go. We want to try to figure out how to create a safe place, but we know how hard it is to talk about these things. Maybe the only things that are harder to talk about than this, the only thing that's the hardest actually is money. That's the thing that nobody really wants to talk about. So we're going to go not as controversial as money, but talk about gun violence instead. And it's not to say that it won't be challenging or even uncomfortable or that we won't have disagreements. We want to be really clear that we do not intend to tell you what your position should be on this. I know a lot of you, and even if I wanted to tell you that, you don't care. So we don't even intend to start there because we know better. That's just kind of who we are, and I love that. But we do want to teach and encourage you and us as pastors in these weeks ahead to try to figure out how our understanding of God and our relationship with Jesus inform the ways that we deal with and address these issues in our everyday lives. That's what we want to do. Again, somebody's going to say this is still a political issue. We shouldn't do that in the church. And I just would remind us that in the early 19th century, when slavery was questioned by some followers of Jesus, not only slave owners, but pastors in every section of our nation that benefited from the enslavement of African peoples stood forward and said that slavery is political and economic matter. It's not really about faith or spirituality or God. And then they even used the Bible to support their position. They said, slaves, obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling in singleness of heart as you obey Christ. And so the capacity to use Paul's letter to the church in Ephesus is just this stark reminder for me of just how easily we can entangle the Bible to mean most anything that we want to. It becomes a mess so quick to justify our own ends. And so I think it's a caution against proof texting and also against just kind of lifting things up to say this is what it says. So Linda and I have chosen Micah. And we're going to spend a little time right now in the prophet Micah looking at these four verses. And I hope it's going to help us just to take a couple steps this morning into more faithful understandings of how we might be in relationship to guns and gun violence. Micah was a prophet in the 8th century BCE. His prophetic witness, his ministry, you could say, it lasted through the rule of three different kings. So that's a long time to reign, and it's a long time to be a prophet in that way. He was concerned, very concerned with the ethical issues that were facing his people. His nation was called Judah, and he was convinced that the brokenness of their nation, the sinfulness, you could say, was going to cause God to use the Assyrians to crush them, to crush who they are in that space. And in the chapter before this one, Micah rails against, this might sound familiar, Micah rails against the crimes of the corrupt officials, the politicians, and the religious leaders of his day for exploiting the people. The priests and the politicos, in Micah's view, were self-serving and corrupt in every way. And Micah first held a mirror up to the people of God in his day and insisted that they look at who they really were, at what was going on around them. And it seems clear to me that they were struggling with a lot of the same things that we're struggling with. Violence was an epidemic in their time, and they were trying to figure out what to do with this. And the answers weren't coming from those in positional authority. Neither the political leaders nor the religious ones seemed to be able to figure out how to help them actually watch over each other in love. And so Micah invited the people of God to dream, to envision a different way forward. He writes, "In days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be raised up above the hills. Peoples shall stream to it, and many nations shall come and say, 'Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth instruction and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between many nations and shall arbitrate between strong nations far away. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. But instead they shall sit under their own vines and under their own fig trees, and no one shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken." Micah is writing about this because his people find themselves continually doing what all of us do. We create us and them. And so Micah is trying to help folks imagine how we blur these lines and move beyond these boundaries of us versus them. Walter Brueggemann, who's a biblical scholar, introduced me to a rabbi named Jonathan Sacks this week, who was at United Hebrew Congregation of the British Commonwealth. And Rabbi Sacks says that the source of violence is found in the dualism. So to try to look beneath the conversation around guns and gun violence, we're going to have to look at how this gets created. And Rabbi Sacks, I think, has some phenomenal wisdom to help us with this. And in this Manichaean fashion, we treat them with hostility and hatred. And we do this in three simple steps. And we do it over and over and over. And you do it and I do it. We all do it all the time. First, the adversary, them, is dehumanized or demonized. It's very hard to talk about these partisan political issues without demonizing something right from the very, very beginning. The second, we come to regard ourselves as victims of them. So we are victims of this dehumanized, demonized other. And then that allows us, it gives us the reason to use altruistic violence or evil to have our way. We do so in the name of good. And once that's set in motion, religion becomes a phenomenal way to justify it. It's woven through all of our biblical text. I was shocked. I'm saying this, Carl was in the room, the small group that that asked me questions as I was being ordained. They didn't ask me about Joel 3. And had they, I would have had no idea what to say to them. This was not in the Bible. It wasn't in my Bible until like Wednesday when I read it. And then I read it 3 times and I kept closing the Bible. Like if I open it one more time, it's not going to be there. Clearly this text is not in the Bible. It can't be. It can't be. That's how, I text Linda, like, do you know this is in the Bible? And it says, beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weakling say, I am strong. Come quickly, all you nations, from every side and assemble there. Bring down your warriors, O Lord. Let the nations be roused. So this part of me wanted to take this like ironic reversal that Joel uses. He takes Isaiah and he takes Micah and he flips them around, right? Like we were ready to go, let's just use Micah. Micah says, take your weapons and melt them into things that are useful so that you can eat, invite people to a table. The problem is when we kept reading, we found this and I didn't want it to be there. And then I added it to this long list of books books is an overstatement, but this long list of verses that I would like to just eliminate from the Bible. Like I would like to do that. This cannot be good. It just can't. So then I wanted to find a creative way to reinterpret it. Well, clearly Joel was being ironic and wanting people to know. Like, this is what Joel was writing. This is what he said. It's what he believed. He wanted you to take all of your materials. I'll use Eric as an example. Like, he wants you to take everything that you're using to create art and make it into a weapon. Like, and so I held that for a while, and in time, it didn't happen right away, but in time, what I started to remember was how it felt to imagine myself in the role of the person with the firearm. To imagine myself in the role as the person who was the shooter, who was trying to take innocent lives. No wonder I wanted to rip that out of the Bible. I don't want to look at that part of myself. I don't want to look at the part of myself that has a tendency to terrorize. I don't want that to be there. I want to cast all of those broken Joel parts, I'll call them. I want to cast them onto others and then demonize them so that I can feel like the world is a little simpler and clearer and maybe I feel a little bit less afraid for at least a moment. And Rabbi Sacks insists that the Jewish interpretive tradition powerfully refuses that very tendency. See, it's in the face of the other. It's in seriously engaging the other and seeing God in the mystery of that engagement with the other that we actually learn to see ourselves, the truth of who we are. And Rabbi Sacks grounds this in a phenomenal study of the book of Genesis, and then finds some textual ground to stand on that helps him untangle our tendencies to see ourselves as chosen and exceptional and everyone else as wrong and in the way. And I find our own Christian tradition has a similar capacity to shape us as well. And it's in the form of a God who is born into the world to an unwed teen girl in the middle of nowhere. See, God comes into the world, crosses every boundary, and becomes flesh. So that whenever we look at another person, our invitation is to see God. To see God, the divine, in the mystery of who that person is. That's crossing every boundary that God comes into creation to show us how to love one another. To say that all means all and God longs for us to see the sacredness of each and every being and person around us. That's where I root myself in our Christian tradition. And it means in part looking in a mirror and acknowledging and seeing both the parts of myself that are a little bit like that fragmented Joel that wants to see myself as chosen and exceptional, and wants to put everything on somebody else and then cast them out. Thankfully, our tradition, as we look into that, it also has us look back in the mirror with the words of Micah that give us this image of what God is calling us to a way of peace and a way of hope that's rooted in an actual transformation of our very lives, of the things that we use in our lives to go about our days, that every sword is melted into tools that we could use to actually invite people to sit at a table and then hold the tensions and the vulnerability of God saying, I'm not going to let you go. I'm going to come and be among you, and we're going to deal with this stuff together, and we're going to find ways. See, in the end, both the prophet Joel and the prophet Micah, in very, very different ways, call us to that table and call me to see both parts of myself, both parts of who I am. Healing, I believe, comes as God calls us into a sympathetic imagination that allows us to see all the parts of who we are and our culture that simultaneously creates mass murderers and victims, both. The abundant table and the life toward which God calls us is one in which every incident of violence ought to be stopped long before it becomes a thought in a person's mind. That's the invitation that God is calling us toward. And I think we're going to have to get underneath some of these things to look in the mirror of who we really are and how God sees us as beloved, even in the midst of that, chooses to be among us, and then calls us to see one another in that very same way. And for me, it's been helpful to just stay with some of these questions that David in his article asks. How can we create the kind of security that acknowledges the reality of evil, but moves toward a deeper kind of security? One that grows out of trust, and I would say grows in seeing ourselves as both mass murderer and victim, so that we can see others as beloved children of God. How can we live with a deeper commitment to reducing violence in every form? In the cultural stories we tell through our movies, through going to Star Wars, through the football game that I watched last night and I'm going to watch again this afternoon, how do I move through some of those ways and find some new ways? In our religious life, in our domestic lives, our disputes, what disciplines is it going to take in terms of raising our children? How do we even begin with that? What I know is this: I can't do that on my own. I need you all to watch over me, and I want to be a part of watching over you. And I need God to transform a lot of parts of myself. Part of how I lean in to both God and to God's refining love and the power of being watched over you all is by returning right here to the table. It was a gift to be away with my family last week, and I also missed being here with you all. It was following Jesus's last meal around a table like that he and his followers went out to a garden. And it was following that meal that he was taken into custody by the state-sanctioned violence of his day, by armed people. And as they did it, one of Jesus' followers started to do what maybe a lot of us do, that Joel piece of taking out a weapon. And Jesus calls him to stop. Stop. See, this meal, in part, reminds me that God is with us in that very struggle. As soon as we become like the followers of Jesus who try to respond with violence, God is there with us, calling us to stop. God witnesses the parts of us that so quickly respond to violence with violence, and at the same time calls us to another way. See, Jesus himself had his life taken through the most violent of acts. And may that truth, that reality of our story, in all of its complexity, may that shape us in the ways of God that lead us to becoming a peaceable kingdom now and always. Amen.
Amen.
When a bullet flies and a child dies, can we overcome? Can we overcome? When all we see is inequality, can we overcome? Can we overcome? Love shall overcome. Love shall overcome. Love shall overcome. Love shall overcome.
Let's do that chorus again. Love.
Love shall overcome. Love shall overcome. Love shall overcome. Love shall overcome.
We refuse.
We refuse to be each other's enemy. We can overcome. We can overcome. When we listen to others' point of view, we can overcome. We can overcome. Love shall overcome. Love shall overcome. Love shall overcome. Love shall overcome. Open our hearts so love can start to heal things.
Open.
Oh.